it's complicated, right? Because we got seven ISOs, or opportunities to participate in markets. But I think I would say that the history, last 10 years, it's been really big wind and solar development. Mostly wind, but solar's been coming on strong the last few years. But those are passive assets. You build them, you bring them in, you bring them online, they're running, and you're in the real-time market, and that's all you need. That plus tax credits, you generally have your business model working. I think what's happened in the last few years is that people have learned that the battery is a different asset class. It's just not the same as wind and solar. But there hasn't been a service provider that was doing optimization of wind and solar. So the opportunity to find someone to help you commercialize your power plants, to think about your opportunities to participate in the different markets, ancillary services to the extent you can, that was sort of a new mindset.
Hello and welcome back to Transmission. Today's conversation is with Habitat Energy's US Managing Director, Mike Kirshner. Mike covers the role of the optimizer and what that entails in the US markets. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode, and it helps others to discover the show. With that, let's jump in.
Mike, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're upstairs at a hotel. We're in a hotel room, which is quite nice, in Austin, Texas. We're here for
beautiful
the
view.
Energy Storage Summit. It is a beautiful view. Energy Storage Summit for the US in 2024. And Mike, we've been meaning to have you on the podcast for a while now, so thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I really appreciate the invitation. Usually I don't get these, so I'm pretty excited when someone says, hey, we want to hear you talk. Most people ask me to be quiet, so this is great.
To set the scene for everybody listening, so Habitat Energy, an optimizer in the UK. Most people listening to this would have heard of Habitat, and you guys are expanding across the US, and Mike is the managing director for that and running, expanding all over North America.
That would be the hope, right? We want to get all the ISOs as fast as we can, right? But we want to start in Texas.
All right. And so before we talk about Habitat and what you're doing there, Mike, do you just want to talk about your experience, what you've been doing in energy, and how you ended up here, please?
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. My previous assignment was vice president of markets and analytics at Vistra Corp. Vistra is the parent company of Texas Utilities, one of the old regulated entities, one of the largest holders of both load and gen in the ERCOT market. They did an acquisition of Dynegy Corporation, which is my previous employer, and they put together what Dynegy had done was to do an M&A across a lot of the U.S. ISOs, California, Midwest, you know, MISO, PJM, Northeast, and effectively built like a very big IPP business across the whole U.S. market. And so my job was like fundamentals of power, fundamentals of natural gas as a driver of our power business, and then, of course, all the analytics that support that. You know, and the battery asset class is sort of the last thing that went into our development pipeline. First projects were coming out. We're struggling with them, how to manage them, how to optimize them. And I got a call from the Habitat team and said, would you like to give us a go? And I thought that'd be a great idea.
And so in your chosen, so you started with ERCOT. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about expansion across the US in a minute, but yeah. I guess it's worth setting the scene that is the market for optimizers or being an optimizer is quite an unusual thing out here.
Yeah.
So if you're listening from Europe or the UK and you're used to asset owners signing a contract with a third party optimizer to trade their power, like Habitat do in the UK and many others, that's not so normal over here, right? And so there's a bit of a challenge, a bit of an education and other bits. So do you want to just talk about that? How does the market work here?
Right. So it's a great question. It's complicated, right? Because we got seven ISOs, or opportunities to participate in markets. But I think I would say that the history, last 10 years, it's been really big wind and solar development. Mostly wind, but solar's been coming on strong the last few years. But those are passive assets. You build them, you bring them in, you bring them online, they're running, and you're in the real-time market, and that's all you need. That plus tax credits, you generally have your business model working. I think what's happened in the last few years is that people have learned that the battery is a different asset class. It's just not the same as wind and solar. But there hasn't been a service provider that was doing optimization of wind and solar. So the opportunity to find someone to help you commercialize your power plants, to think about your opportunities to participate in the different markets, ancillary services to the extent you can, that was sort of a new mindset, you know, and because there's so many big players in the U.S. That dominate most of the footprint, I think it reduced the amount of people that would want to acquire those services because they had the ability to do that work in-house. I think what's interesting about the development of batteries is that like the development cycle is a little bit faster, real estate requirements are a little bit smaller. And so I think a lot of people have been able to get the land and make that work, but then they get to the market and it's like, what do I do now? You know, and that's where I think Habitat's got a real opportunity to provide like the commercialization service from the development and the in-service date back to how do I get full value out of the asset in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, it's challenging in that the optimizer market isn't mature here in the US.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's a massive opportunity, right? Because right. having an edge and providing those services in an intelligent way could be a real game changer. Let's talk about Habitat now. So the company's been going 5 or 6 years. Could you give a brief overview of Habitat to date and then where you guys are headed? What's the big vision?
Okay. I'm going to speak for the leadership team who are, you know, like my bosses who founded the company. But, you know, going back 6, 7 years, I think they sat down and looked at the way batteries were being deployed, their fit in the new market development, like how the footprint was going to be broken out, and identified the battery as like a, you know, like a necessary solution, right? The idea, you can't have that much non-dispatchable assets and maintain stability. So it's an engineering problem that the battery just naturally solves. But how do you get the market mechanics to work is a whole nother problem. And I think, you know, they saw that in the UK first and built the company from scratch there. And I think in many cases had to follow the exact like outline that you laid out, where they have to like educate clients, teach them what's possible, demonstrate what kind of capability would deliver that value, and then build it out and build confidence around it. And I think that that track record you see over the first 3 or 4 years of Habitat 2017 to 2020, and then I think they expanded into Australia. They looked at expanding into some of the European markets. And then around 2021, I believe that's when Quinbrook came in and said, hey, I think we'd like to like take this to the US. Your footprint matches our footprint. And I think, you know, they took us private, gave us the capital we needed to begin building out our business, particularly the US market. And that's kind of how we got to this point today.
And so Habitat is fully owned by Quinbrook, is that right?
That's correct.
And probably worth noting, I mean, my experience in the last few years, the first time I heard the word optimizer in this realm was Habitat. They basically coined the phrase in my mind back in 2017 2018,
right?
And now it's just a standard thing. So okay, let's talk about the big vision then. Where are you guys headed? Obviously the US is a really important market to you.
Yeah,
but what's the big picture here?
So you know, the way I think about it is, you know, we want to be a national company. We want to be able to provide these services across the U.S. A lot of the clients that we're looking to service in ERCOT are planning to build and develop projects in other markets or acquire projects in other markets. So our goal is to be everywhere. It's hard to do that all at once, though. And so we elected to choose ERCOT as our start point. I think the opportunity to be in a market that's energy only plays really strongly to the battery capability, right? Also the fact that, you know, the ORDC structure, you know, is a big part of it. It creates a really strong offer cap, you know, $5,000 price cap, used to be $9,000, but it's a very strong incentive to be like opportunistic, and the battery is just really well suited for that. If we can do this in this market, the Texas market, with its penetration of wind and what we see is the growth in solar, I think the other markets are following suit, right? Texas is just naturally gifted with wind and solar like capability. You look at the maps of where you get the best wind performance, where you get the best solar performance. Texas is like the nexus of those two maps, right? PJM, not so much for the solar, right? Some wind. You know, every market's got a little bit different, but no, California is great for solar. Wind is okay. Texas is great for everything. So if we can get good here, I think our sense is that we can be really good everywhere. And, you know, the economies of scale that come with expansion, we'd expect to see that, you know, we can provide this optimization service for, you know, eventually, you know, just a small premium over what would be a SaaS model and really, you know, improve people's performance. And ultimately, as a business, our mission is to expand how quickly renewables get brought into the system. So, you know, maximizing their returns is how we make sure that the system gets greener over time.
Can we just take stock of where Habitat's at right now? So how many people are working on the company or in the company? It's a bit like a project, isn't it? How many people are working on the project? Where are they based?
Right.
What's the bit that you look after? So you look after the US, but how many people are doing that? Let's just get some numbers and some idea about who's working on what.
Right. We're not quite at 100. That's like a milestone. We were having a conversation about, you know, we should have a celebration when we get there. But let's say 90 is sort of where we're sitting at as an organization. Probably maybe a little over half of that is sitting in the UK, spread between Oxford and London, right? That general area. And then I think in the US, we have about 15 or 20, probably more like 20 now. We keep hiring people, so it's hard to keep track. I think we're about 20, and then the Australia business has got another 10 or 15 people, something like that. So that's generally, I think, where we're sitting. And, you know, obviously we intend to continue to grow. And our goal is to have, you know, I mean, as many people as we need, right? And as we build out our business, obviously the demands will go up with it.
And what's the model? Because you guys are very, you're technology driven. Mm-hmm. Right. So if I understand your pitch, a lot of it is about forecasting and machine learning and really using data as an advantage in the market.
Yeah.
But then also you have loads of people, right? You got 90 people. I didn't realize it was that many.
Right.
So I know some of them build software. That makes sense. But yeah. Then what do the other guys do? Are they looking after the software? Are they over, you know, what's happening?
No, it's a good question. You know, the value chain in the commercial organization is, you know, front, middle, back office. So you've got to have credit, right? You got to be managing the cash flows. You know, there's a lot of operational risk with managing someone else's asset through the queasy structure that we typically employ with our clients. You know,
queasy, just for anyone who's not from this market.
Yes.
Qualifying scheduling entity, right?
Yep.
That means it's basically market access. So that means that you can play in the market.
Right.
Sorry.
No, that's right.
QSC or queasy.
And part of that QSC or qualified scheduling entity structure is that you have the collateral to participate in the market. ERCOT being one of the more volatile power markets in the world, certainly in our country, there's a lot of reasons to like be very careful with how you operate and what risks you take. You know, everyone remembers Winter Storm Uri. There's been a couple of winter storms since then that continue to demonstrate how difficult the market is in the wintertime. And then last summer, if you know, you're watching August of 2023, there was a heat dome that sat over the state for about 45 days.
That's when I've just moved to Texas. Yes. It was brutal.
It's hard to want to stay when you've seen that kind of weather, I think. But, you know, it's not like that all the time.
Yeah,
you know?
It's beautiful now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Definitely winter peaking for humans, right? Like we'd like to be there in the wintertime.
How does that work? Just out of interest. So they're posting collateral to, mm-hmm. to access ERCOT. Is it expensive? Can small players do it? Could Habitat have done this without the backing, the, you know, the big parent backing? Or yeah, how does that work?
There really isn't a choice. You have to do it. So if you're building an asset, that just has to be part of your business plan. The way you do it, though, can be more or less efficient depending on how you structure your entity. So partnering with a queasy, partnering with another player that has assets and receivables goes a long way to help alleviate that. When you're a net receiver of cash, you generally don't need a lot of collateral because you're, in some sense your receivables are managing that for you. But the minute you have an operating issue, your unit goes down, you have to buy back your position, that can invert your cash flows, and you have to make sure that you've got the right balance sheet behind it. I think we'd be a lot less comfortable with our capabilities without Quinbrook's support. And I think our clients feel the same way. Like it's a natural fit, I think, for what we're able to do and how we want to provide value to have their investment and support for the organization.
So you got to have money in your pocket to even play in this market, because our prices can go so high in ERCOT, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you think about, that's true. So, you know, for every megawatt, you could lose $5,000 because you could sell it for 50 and have to buy it back for 5,000. But it's more than that. Is with the batteries, you can stack ancillaries ahead. So I could sell RRS for 24 hours, but if I had to buy it back because my unit went down, I'm buying 24 times my 1 hour battery's capacity times that $5,000. And that's where the leverage really bites you.
Buy back your ancillary services.
Yeah. You can. There's bilateral transactions. There's not really liquid markets, and that's something we'll probably touch on as we go through the questions. That's something that I think needs to evolve. But certainly, you know, we get on the phones during the day and we get calls during the day from other trading shops that are saying, hey, we need some. Can you give us some? And then we, you know, find a way to trade.
All right. Well, let's get into that then.
All right.
Another take stock, if you don't mind. So let's do some numbers. You guys operate a lot of assets around the world. Can you just talk through what those assets, you know, the customers you work with, what the assets look like? Yeah, just a few numbers to get us ready for the next bit about how you guys actually do it.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I know the UK is operating about a gigawatt today, certainly under contract, maybe double that. In the US, we're operating 60 megawatts from a sister company of Quinbrook, but we've got over a gig of sales completed for this year.
So 60 megawatts online in ERCOT right now through Quinbrook.
Yep. And then another gig coming through the remainder of the year, names to be released later.
You can't do it now.
You know, we no, not yet. Like, I bet that's the one thing I was told I have to keep like quiet. So I'm gonna do my job.
All right, okay.
But it's a good question.
Can I name some names and then you cough at the right time?
But the UK team, I think we can talk about Pulse. You know, we've got Eel, we've got several, I think, big players. And then, you know, in Australia, we've still got a couple of those players as well. And Quinbrook is obviously one of their investment companies, portfolio companies, are also our clients.
All right. So it's probably worth setting the scene with a bit of a sales pitch for you guys. So when you're trying to sell your optimization services, particularly in the US, in ERCOT,
yes,
and you're selling it to a market which has historically done this stuff themselves, mm-hmm. you're saying, give us the keys to your asset and we're going to do it better than you can, right? I think.
Yes.
What does that look like? What does that sales pitch actually, how does it go down?
Well, I don't think we walk in and say we're going to do it better than you, just because, you know, you don't want to take an adversarial position day one. But I think what we try to do is explain the unique attributes of the battery and like the battery class, and just say, you know, ERCOT is a market where you have to offer and be accepted before you can participate. So you have to be changing your offer curves every 5 minutes. Were you planning on doing that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year? We build automation for that. That's our software. You'd asked about like the value proposition. And I think that's kind of where we would go to. It's like, you know, we built this for you broadly, like the people that have this asset. And we think if you have this capability, it makes your job easier to get that full value out of your platform.
So every 5 minutes, you're adjusting your bid and offer curves, your prices that you're submitting to ERCOT, constantly readjusting and depending on what you're thinking or the software is thinking, the market.
Exactly. And that's just in the real time, right? We also have forecasters for the day ahead market where we look and we say, you know, what do we think is going to happen tomorrow? What do we think the utilization rates are going to be? How much stacking can we do, right? You sell 1 hour of RRS, but the utilization rate is under 1%. Well, then I can afford to sell hours 2, 3, 4, 5 all the way through the end of the day. And I don't worry about having state of charge compliance issues, right? But if I don't do that, and I'm not forecasting utilization, if utilization goes to 50%, I'll quickly find myself like out of energy and no opportunity to buy it back. And then I have to buy back the position, right? And make sure that I've got it covered. And that's where you get yourself in trouble. Because when you don't show up, that's when ERCOT might find that there's an RDC event because you're not there when you were supposed to be and the price were to spike and now you're buying back and giving a loss. The term I like to use is, you know, you make your money in day ahead, you give it back in real time. And our job is to make sure that you keep it, right? That we make sure that we manage that state of charge actively and ensure that you're getting your full value without having to like be nervous about the risks involved.
That's a good phrase. You make your money day ahead and you give it. You think you get to keep it?
You try not to give it back in real time.
In real time.
Yeah.
All right. You heard it here first. Now I want to ask you about expansion across the US. And this comes from a position of course, Modo Energy is doing the same thing. We started in ERCOT. We're launching in California soon. I think if we're honest with ourselves in a company, mm-hmm. we underestimated how different each region is and how hard it was going to be. If you're really going to do a good job at what we do, which is similar to, it's very, you know, very different businesses, but we do, we need the same kind of information and data. And we really believe in understanding it to the 100th degree, if you like. Well, I think we underestimated how hard it was going to be to understand each region and do it properly, right? Not cut corners.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know how you guys are going to expand across the US, because for us, we've had to throw way more time, energy, and money at it to get it right.
It's a great point. I've been trading these ISOs for a long time. And so, and you know, the benefit of having worked for the big IPPs, I've seen all the ISOs and I can compare and contrast, right? I know the difference between MISO and PJM and the Northeast and California and Texas, and you can use that information. There's probably, if you've got a Venn diagram, I'm kind of nerdy, so I like to draw all that stuff out, right? But if you had a Venn diagram, you could see like there's a lot of overlap, but there's every ISO is going to have some unique attributes. And those attributes are not something you can just gloss over, right? Some of those things are really important and they need to be captured. So, you know, the first step is just knowing what it is on the ground that's driving value. Second part is figuring out like what makes that happen? Like, what are the rules? What are the procedures? What are the processes? What are the client, you know, strategic behaviors that make all that possible? And then, you know, building out the algorithms and the underpinning tech to be able to kind of tease that information out. But I think the idea that there's a single answer for every market is just not true. I think you really have to look at the United States more like you would look at Europe and look at each country sort of in its own isolated view. There's certainly some interplay between them, right? The tie lines and things like that. But overall, I think each ISO is really its own market and it has to be like decomposed and analyzed that way. I think, you know, from our purposes, ERCOT is maybe the most complicated because of its reliance on energy to provide full compensation to all of the generator classes. So I think the idea of getting it right here, you know, and particularly with the energy part, which is with battery controls, is going to make it easier when we move into markets with capacity.
Yeah, I mean, that's a completely different way of operating a fleet, right?
Yeah.
I got to say, it's just, I love this job and what we do at Modo because it's you get to learn stuff and you get to go fast and do lots of new things. But I must say, you know, USA expansion, it's been the other regions beyond, we thought we would be way faster. It's been quite humbling. It's good to have humbling moments sometimes. And yeah, we're focused now.
Well, I have the benefit of not being humble yet because I haven't tried, so I don't know how hard it is exactly. I only know that I've done those other markets before, which gives me a little bit of an advantage. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's not obvious where the best markets are either. You know, as much as like you might look at California and say, you know, look at the amount of batteries there, look at, you know, what's going on. But you're talking about 4-hour batteries. So your optimization, you know, the first hour is more valuable, the second more valuable, and the third, fourth. So, you know, how much can you add as an optimizer, right? The capacity market in California is very strong. So those capacity pay months many times are, you know, 10, 15 year lock-in deals. So there's not a lot we can do to help those revenues, right? So, you know, our value proposition is going to be smaller in those markets than it's going to be in ones that are more reliant on energy. So, you know, as we think about expansion, we're going to want to go both where the megawatts are being developed, but also where we think, you know, we can take advantage of our platform. And, you know, hopefully as we get economies of scale, we'll be able to fill out all the other ISOs through time.
And how are you guys thinking about co-located assets? Because in California, for example, there's a lot more solar with battery. We're going to have a lot more co-located assets in the future. And it's a fairly complex optimization problem.
Yeah.
How are you guys? Do you have any co-located assets right now? And do you have any thoughts about how best to optimize those?
So we don't have any co-located assets in Texas, but we do have some in Australia. And our tech teams have been working very hard on building out the optimization algorithms where we're optimizing them together, right? And that part of it is generalizable, right? If you can optimize two things, regardless of what they are, then in some sense, you can optimize N things, right? You just have to be able to expand that framework out. And that's where the tech guys give us a lot of advantages. And so we do have a starting point anyway, to pick that up as we bring it in. Where we see portfolio effects first in ERCOT is where we have clients with multiple sites, right? And there's some things we can do with portfolio effects in ERCOT now, even without co-located assets, by just thinking optimally about how we would transfer obligations intraday between ancillaries. Ancillaries don't have deliverability requirements. One of the things that may not, or I know you'd know, but maybe some of your listeners don't know, the US has LMP, right? Locational marginal pricing, which means every node is different from every other node. And that means there's congestion between those nodes. And batteries both create and alleviate congestion depending on direction and where they're located. So there's a lot of interplay between multiple batteries in the system and the opportunities to arbitrate energy versus ancillary prices. So we can make commitments in day ahead that we think are optimal across the fleet, but then we can also move those obligations intraday because the ancillaries can be moved between locations without basis. And that means we can be longer in the places where the basis advantage is bigger. So we're already finding that portfolio effects are an augmentation to economic performance as we have multiple sites, as we have multiple asset classes. I think we're going to see even more of that, right? Where we can use the wind or the solar or even load, right, to backstop some of our positions and trade slightly differently. That is both profit and risk maximizing from the value proposition to the client.
Now let's talk about the exciting bit. Let's talk about trading. And Habitat for many years have been really at the forefront of talking and educating the market about the merchant opportunity. And so after ancillary services become saturated, what comes next? You know, power trading, buy cheap, sell expensive, that kind of stuff. And it's a lot more complicated than that. But I wanted to ask you about how you actually set that up, because you're a software business, but you also have human traders. And how does that actually work in practice?
I mean, you know, you build a commercial desk, right? I mean, I think that's where we started from. Again, born in the IPP space, independent power producer space. You know, I've been doing this for 25 years. You know, the way front office would usually be set up, right? You'd have like your trading groups, you have your cash, you have your, you know, like short-term, medium, long. And then, you know, you'd have maybe your fuels books, right? And then you have your middle and back office. And so, you know, we just started with that. We started with the front office. We need people that can trade these batteries when they're online. And then we said, okay, we need to be able to manage cash collateral. We need to be able to manage credit. We need to be able to look at, you know, trading opportunities with other counterparties. And we started building out those things. We built our supplier, you know, who's going to support us, where we're going to get our information from, forward curves. And then, you know, once you have that, it's like, this is the secret to what makes Habitat unique. And I think what, you know, ultimately is part of our value proposition is just the fact that like the traders are part of the data science team, that, you know, we work together collaboratively. So you have a commercial organization that's bringing an asset to market, making their best call on a human level, augmented by automation and tech that's doing this like in real time and updating with the latest data. You know, those two things together, they lead to sometimes different conclusions, but it's in that friction that we create new features and new like ways of thinking about the market. And, you know, they're challenging each other. And that, I think that interaction is where we get the code where we want it, and our traders get to add value because the market is constantly seeing experiences it's never seen before. We've never had, you know, 20 gigawatts of solar in the system, right? Like that's new today. We've never had 7 megawatts or 6 gigawatts of batteries in the system. So it's one thing to say the backcast looks like we should do this. It's another thing to say that still makes sense under the circumstances right now. So I think one of our traders used the term, you know, autopilot. You might use your autopilot to fly the plane 99% of the time, but when things get scary, you want somebody responsible taking over. And that's where our trade team really shines, is stepping in when things are hairy. And we had that issue, you know, during summer of last year. And, you know, it was worked out really well for our client, worked out really well for us.
So on that, there must have been times where the software that you guys have built have said, do X. And then human has said, no, I want to do Y, which is interesting. But I think the more interesting thing is the other way around, right? Where, and the human was right.
Yeah.
Where the software said, do X, and the human said, no, I think Y is better. And the software was actually right.
Yep.
And surely as the software gets better and better and better, those things will happen more and more.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys believe that on a longer horizon, the automation will win out in the end? Or do you think it will always be a hybrid model? And the reason why I ask that is there's sort of two camps at the moment, aren't there? There's some folks who are building really sophisticated automated systems for this. And they're going, automation is the future. We're not going to have 24/7 humans. This is about computers, not brains, right?
Yep.
And then there's the other camp, the more traditional trading floor camp, which is like, yeah, we'll take some inputs and we'll look at some graphs, but this is our game. We're used to this. We've been running gas plants for ages.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys are somewhere in the middle. I'm just interested about where you are along that. It's a spectrum, and whether that changes over time.
Yeah, it's a great question. I hope I have a good answer. But my view is that it's going to be a hybrid forever. And the reason I say that is, it's not that I don't think that the tech will win in some sense that if the system is stable, then the tech can learn it and do a great job. And you can displace all the humans. But I've been doing this for 25 years, and the system's never been stable. We've never had the ORDC curve be the same in Texas for any length of time. We've never had the supply stack remain stable. Right?
What's the ORDC curve for folks at home?
The operating reserve demand curve. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks,
like,
Neil.
I say it as an acronym, but like, yeah. But the ORDC curve is the Texas equivalent of a capacity market, and effectively forces prices towards the cap, even when like people aren't offering at that price, as a way of creating economic rents that are replacing what would have been paid by a capacity market. So the ORDC curve is a really important part of getting that credit, getting that economic rent to make sure your assets stay in the game. And the we've been having to tune it as the grid is changing, as, you know, tax subsidies. I mean, there's just all these things that influence market design. And there's so many players that are all trying to influence it. It's constantly evolving. And I think that's really where the tension between the data science and the tech and our traders is where the value is that the traders know what the implications of policy are. and strategic, like, you know, behaviors of other players, whereas data science finds those patterns and, you know, can repeat it, you know, from all the noise. And I think the join of those two things is where you get like the best answer overall. And more to the point, it allows you to continually stay sharp, right? Because they're always testing one another.
Maybe I'm just, if I was a software engineer working at Habitat, I swear, I would just want the software to win. I'd be like, get those guys out of the way.
Yeah.
Let's build software that can do this. But maybe I'm biased.
Well, I think the internal competition is actually healthy, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, how do you even comp everyone, right? So if you're gonna give people, last deep question, but if you're gonna pay bonuses based on performance, which is probably a good thing in this industry,
yep.
Then if you've got the computer telling you one thing and the trader telling you another, how do you sort that out?
You know, I think we look at it in a holistic way, right? I mean, you know, the jobs are, I mean, yes, you want everyone to be incentivized, but you want them to be incentivized for the work that they're doing, right? And certainly, you know, traders are aggressive. They a lot of times have to put in some strange hours, you know, to make sure the client's getting support 24/7. You know, whereas, you know, it's not necessarily a requirement for the software guys. Sometimes they choose to do that, but that's like, you know, self-selection. But I think really it comes down to, you know, we want people that want to win. And we want people who are constantly pushing what we understand, what we think we know. And, you know, we try to find that in our software people as well as our traders. Just as a funny anecdote, one of our software guys used to be a professional poker player. And like, you know, we think he might become a trader someday. I mean, you know, we'd expect to see some bleed over from the types of folks that we're hiring, where they could fill either role over time, because, you know, the skills are really coming together between the technical and the commercial.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, excited to see how that progresses. And all right, we're going to move to the last two questions now. So what do you want to plug? Anything you want to announce? You did say there's some big clients in ERCOT that have just signed a gigawatt, right? So this is your chance to let everyone know.
Yeah, I'd love to reveal their names, and we will. But right now, I think we're waiting on some paperwork to get done, you know, IP stuff. But practically speaking, you know, the signing's taken place, and we've already started the process of moving those assets into our QSE. But I think, you know, the real milestone for us is that, you know, they're not Quinberg companies, right? So we've got like third parties that have looked and vetted us against the competition. And, you know, we're real excited to take that, you know, to the market when we can. But really, I think, you know, we've got so much opportunity in front of us. And, you know, these guys are bought into our way of thinking. And, you know, I think they're going to be a good spokesman for our organization and, you know, help us to kind of like get other people on board with the approach that we're taking.
And on to the last question. Interested to hear your contrarian view. So what do you believe that you reckon most other people don't believe?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know if I could say for sure what other people believe, but I've seen people scared of building batteries, right? And you know, one of the things that I believe as the, you know, power fundamentals kind of person building DCOPF models, looking at long-term forecasts, I don't see that problem. I look at the amount of coal and steam gas in the ERCOT system. I see what's going on in the mid-continent with some of the Obama-era retirement requirements for some of the coal. I mean, we're talking 40, 50 gigawatts that are going to have to come out of the system, a baseload generation. You know, it's hard for me to see how the system with wind and solar is just going to like be stable, fingers crossed. Like, it seems to me that you're going to need these flexible, fast-moving, what I would coin a digital asset, which is how I think about the battery in these markets, you know, very active and lots of them like spread out all over the footprint. So, you know, to me, you know, I'm surprised that it's not happening faster. I'm surprised that the financing is so difficult. I think it has to do with the cash flow expectations and the modeling. We talked a little bit about liquidity. I think it's hard to know the forward value of volatility in these markets. You know, we have pretty liquid, you know, gas markets. We have pretty liquid power markets, at least out 1 or 2 years. But volatility is hard to trade, and it's hard to trade locally at LMPs. So I think, you know, as we create other ways of doing bilateral transactions, as we get some structured products kind of like into the market, I think that's going to really speed up the development of storage in the United States. And that's, I think, very good for, you know, the industry and reliability. But I think it's also very good for Habitat. So I'm really excited to be part of it.
So which was the contrarian bit?
Well, I don't see people building. I mean, not the way I would have thought. I mean, given what I think is wrong with the system and the kind of like vol we've seen, you know, you think about ERCOT 21, 22, 23, we've seen increasing economic performance for any type of battery anywhere in the system, year over year over year. And while we're seeing growth, I don't think we're seeing the growth that the queue would imply. I don't think we're seeing the same commitment that, like, you might, you know, people are getting themselves in there to give themselves the option, but I don't see everybody pulling the trigger. And I'm curious as to why that is, because I look at how much room we have to grow and I look at how fast it's being built. And from a reliability standpoint, there's parts of my analysis I'm like, hey, that looks bad. Like, I just feel like we need to be moving a little bit faster. So maybe that's not contrarian, given that we're at a battery conference.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, there is some sense that, like, the system's okay. You know, ERCOT's telling us we have 40% reserve margins. I'm just not feeling 40% kind of confident.
At this conference, we just shared some of our work on net load ramps and what next year and the next couple of years looks like. I mean, you just following net load ramps, like 30-minute ramps, you've got to think we're going to have some spiky prices in ERCOT. It is, and then you're adding 5 gigs a year of demand.
Yeah.
It is incredible. As a European watching ERCOT add 5 gigs of demand every year, I wonder whether with electrification, max demand is almost like a proxy for GDP growth now, with, you know, moving primary fuel away from fossil into electrification. I don't know. That's not any diss on Europe, but there is a deindustrialization happening in many countries. But yeah, so your belief is you can't believe we're not building batteries faster. It doesn't make sense.
I would say I'm surprised we're not more bullish, right? Particularly as the financing side of the house. And I think it really comes down to getting those, you know, equity cases, financing cases across the finish line. And I think it comes down to having visibility into the future markets. So when we get some liquidity there and we start seeing some, you know, volume trading, I think I'm hoping that'll open up the door to the, you know, the banks, and then, you know, open up the money flow, and then we'll start to see that development and really accelerate the turnover of the legacy, you know, carbon-based tech.
All right. I want to say a massive thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been a delight. And yeah, really looking forward to seeing how you and the Habitat team get on in the US. Wish you the best of luck. You guys are going to smash it, no doubt.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.